On to item six, consider and take possible action regarding the following disability retirement application for Walter Wong, seeking a service-connected disability. Donnie, did you have anything to say before we present the item?
Yes, I need to recuse myself from consideration on this. Walter, who went by the name of Terrence, was a good friend of mine, and I filled out the application for disability benefit on behalf of his employer. So I was going to recuse from this and actually leave the Zoom meeting while this is under consideration.
Thank you, Donnie. And can staff confirm that Donnie's no longer in the Zoom meeting?
Yes, we can confirm that.
Thank you. Okay, so taking up the item, do we have Tim on the line, or was someone going to present this item?
I'm Scott. I'm at Todd. I'm actually on the line.
Okay. Would you please present the item?
Yes. Okay. Agenda item number six. It's an application for a service-connected disability related to Walter Wong, a safety member. On September 4th, 2020, Walter Wong, a 41-year-old deputy sheriff, criminalist three with the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office, passed away unexpectedly from a heart-related condition. Mr. Wong had over 18 years of service with the sheriff's office at the time of his death. A service-connected disability application was filed on his behalf by his employer. The medical advisor reviewed the medical records provided as well as the laws regarding the heart presumption for safety members. The medical advisor opined that Mr. Wong was permanently disabled from his duties at the time of his death and that his death was caused by heart trouble. SACERA's Disability Council reviewed the death certificate, the medical advisor's report, as well as the laws regarding the heart presumption, and opined that the prerequisites of the heart presumption were met, therefore service connection is presumed, and that the records support a finding of a service-connected disability. You've been provided with the medical advisor's report as well as SACERA's Disabilities Council's analysis. Their recommendation is to grant Mr. Wong's application for a service-connected disability pursuant to Government Code 31720 and 31720.5, which is the heart presumption.
Thank you, Tim. Open it up for discussion.
Question?
Scott?
Yeah. I'm a little perplexed about the posture of this case on our public calendar because the bulk, if not all of the information that's relevant to the case, it has been provided on a confidential basis. So my first question is, I need some rules of the road here on what can be discussed in the public session versus not. I'm hoping Karen or Tim or both can opine on that. Anyway, so that's my first question. I just need to understand what we can do and say and not say, in this session.
Good question.
I'm happy to respond, Scott. That's a good question. Under the Brown Act, generally, the board is allowed to go into closed session to consider disability applications. However, that is done under an attorney general opinion that came down in 2005. And it is limited to situations where the consideration of the matter may impact the employment status of the employee, the member. In a situation where the member is deceased, that is no longer the case. And so in situations such as this, where the member is no longer an employee, we take this item to the board in open session. We don't have the authorization to hold a closed session on this item. In terms of what can be discussed, the board should ask questions and discuss whatever you think is relevant to the decision. even if it is in the confidential packet, it's there because we attempt to protect that more medical personal information from disclosure to the public. But to the extent that the board needs to discuss it in order to reach a decision today, you should feel free to do so.
Okay, so I mean, I guess the conundrum here is probably pretty obvious to everybody that all of the facts that are relevant to this case are in confidential memos. And since we have a decedent situation, the same rationale that has us taking the matter into open session because the person is no longer employed, as an active member should apply to the information. I'm hard pressed to discuss this without getting into the underlying materials. I don't know how you do that as a practical matter, unless we're just expected to vote to approve it and move on. Cause I don't know how you would have discourse on this without the confidential memos. And it seems to me, I don't understand the point of confidentiality since the member is now deceased. I'll stop there.
Okay. Were you hoping for expansion from Karen or just putting that on record?
Well, I guess both, but at this point, it sounds like if I feel I need to discuss the information in the memos, that I can do that in the public meeting and I'm not going to violate someone's right of privacy or some other legal principle I'm not thinking of. Is that fair to say?
That is correct, Scott. You may discuss that information in open session.
Okay.
You may discuss whatever you feel is necessary for the board's consideration of this matter and reaching a decision.
Okay. So I have a couple more questions on this one. Procedurally, who, if anyone, is charged with the responsibility to assert the rebuttal aspect of the rebuttable presumption? That is, you have a person who, according to the evidence we have, was employed actively until August 20, was gainfully employed and working, not disabled, but working, went on vacation and died on vacation. What I would, just as a layperson say, appeared to be a massive heart attack. That's what it sounded like. I know David will correct me, but that's how it read to me. So the question I have is, first of all, even questioning whether this person was disabled since they were an active employee, fully employed as of August 20th, is who, if anyone, is charged with marshaling facts or trying to rebut the presumption? Who's the natural force to do that in this case?
Staff, either Karen or Tim?
I'm happy to respond.
Thank you, Karen.
It is Sarah's burden of proof to rebut a presumption. It is the applicant's burden of proof to show that the presumption's elements are met. In this case, they did that, as you can see from the reports and memos that you've received.
Okay, so if that's the case, then it's up to Cicera to be the person to question the presumption. It sounded to me like the Vivian Schultz memo was basically sought to ratify the decision, not to seriously question it. I didn't really understand the purpose of that memo other than to be a supporting element in the record that would provide for the presumption. She didn't address to me the fundamental question, which is that this person, unlike someone who's been off or who has some type of injury, whether or not it's post-traumatic stress injury or a physical injury, like a back injury, an ankle injury, repeated treatment, evaluations, medical appointments, we don't have any of that. This person was fully and gainfully employed and worked until August 20 by the record, and then went on vacation and died. I don't understand how that's a disabled person. So I'm struggling with that. Vivian Schultz did nothing to address that issue And seems to me her task, as I read it, was simply to rubber stamp what had been provided. That's my opinion, but I've read this several times and I'm perplexed by the whole posture of the case. So, I mean, I have a real concern about, so I guess fundamentally, how is this person disabled? I don't know who can answer that, but how is a person who is actively employed, who is not treated for this condition, who made it to work every day to August 20th and went on vacation, disabled? That's my question. I need to hear an answer to that.
Well, and Scott, I'm going to jump in because I'm usually with you on this one. I think in some of the other cases, when we've had this whole disability thing, it's when we found someone who's dead and we don't know if there's any intervening period. I think in this instance, one could argue, because if I recall the facts, he called 911, and as he headed out to greet them, he collapsed, something like that. Am I making up facts? Okay. I don't. And so there you've got at least an intervening period of a disability. And so I had less problem with this one than I have with the other ones where it's just instant. I think the greater question for me isn't the disability issue. It's the service-connected disability. Is this truly service-connected? And there you've got the presumption. If it's coronary, it must be. In this case, it sounds like he was obese. I don't know how obese he was, or you know, how sitting behind a desk, this is somehow service connected, because it sounds like he was primarily a desk-related job. You know, I'm having a harder time with the service connection than I am with the disability, because at least there was this intervening period where, yeah, you can argue, based upon the standards we've been given, there was this brief moment in time where he said, I'm having a heart attack. I need to call 911. I've got a disability. It's more akin to the judge being in the hospital and dying while in the hospital. So that's where I'm not as torn up with that part, but I have a harder time with the presumption.
I'm having the same problem with you know, the operation of the presumption here and service connection, because we haven't gotten to that piece yet, which is understanding the medical condition. And it sounds like he had arterial problems, that if at least I'm understanding some of the rationale in these cases, is not necessarily, quote, heart trouble, right? And so he seemed to have things that were other than heart trouble that caused or contributed to his demise. So I do have the same issue, but I understood the disability discussion that we've had previously in the context of the active death option. So this is not an active death case.
No, not true. I you're right. I was bringing up more of the active death one. You're right.
So when I analyzed it by that, even I don't know if we've actually ever come back and adopted a standard.
That's true.
It's on my to-do list of things that we are long lingering. And when I saw this case in the packet, I first thought that's what it was, until you got into it, realized it was actually a disability case filed by the employer. So, I mean, the principles may be the same, Candace, but I saw the posture is different for what it's worth. So I'm troubled by the service connection as well.
So the presumption, maybe I need further on this. So, and to address Scott's statements regarding Vivian's letter. So is it Cicera's role, like, and I'm sorry to the lawyers on the line, like a defense attorney where you're going to find a defense no matter what? And again, this might be a poor analogy. Is our job to try to find a way to do the presumption, or are we somewhat neutral, but we analyze it and then just present what we've analyzed? I'm not so sure what Cicera the system's role is. Like, I view it more like we have an obligation to review it, but are we supposed to try to find a way to deny this? Karen, I just need clarity. I'm sorry.
Absolutely. The presumption is a little tricky. The presumption is in the law, it's in the SRL. The presumption is there's certain elements that have to be met for the member to enjoy the benefit of the presumption. In this case, with the heart trouble presumption, which is in Government Code Section 317.20.5, there's five elements that need to be met. This is where the role of SACERA is to review and see if those conditions have been met. So the member has to be a safety member. The member must have completed at least 5 years of service. The member developed heart trouble. And that's where the medical advisor's report comes in, because they review all of the medical reports, records, death certificate, and tell us whether there was heart trouble, which in this case was found to be the case, and that the member was permanently incapacitated due to that heart trouble. Again, that was met here as well based on the medical advisor's report. And if those elements are met, then the law tells us that we presume that that the member's condition, death, arose out of their employment. That's the service connection part of the disability decision. The first part is always, was there incapacity, permanent incapacity from the performance of their duties, okay? The second one is service connection. So the presumption provides the service connection part. It means that if all these elements are met, the member doesn't have to show service connection, okay? But that presumption is rebuttable, meaning if there's any evidence that show that maybe the condition didn't arise out of the employment, then the burden shifts to SACERA to prove that. So SACERA would have to go out and get evidence to prove that the condition did not arise out of employment. In this case, both the medical advisor that reviewed the medical records and SACERA's Disability Council concluded that there's no facts, no evidence to support a rebuttal. Todd's question goes to who needs to actively go out and get that information? And the answer is it would be SACERA, but in this case, there's no reason to do so.
Okay, so in your professional opinion, Vivian's assessment is appropriate in that all five elements were met and we didn't have any evidence of this, any outside, I can't remember the word you just used, but if in her assessment, all five were met and we had no evidence to the contrary, that her letter is appropriate?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, that's helpful to me when evaluating this, in that we could not rebut the assumption and these five elements were met. So I would be in favor of a motion that granted a service-connected disability. I'll open it up to more comments.
Can I ask another question or two, Todd?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. We'll try this.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not a doctor. Don't play one on television either. But it's when you read through Dr. Blink's analysis, and I understand probably why he came to this conclusion, he cites a number of anatomical issues that likely contributed to this unfortunate eventuality. He doesn't opine, and perhaps is not in a position to opine, as to when those particular issues arose. One could assume, it seems to me, one of the assumptions you could make is that he came to his job with those anatomical challenges. Perhaps they didn't help him while he was working, but that he didn't develop those anatomical coronary issues prior to his employment. So that's where I have a problem with the presumption. It just isn't as clear cut for me. With firefighters, I understand it's very difficult to sit there and dispute the cancer presumption because there are so many instances in which they are confronted with hazardous substances during the course of their duties as firefighters. I get that. But in this case, it doesn't seem to be clear to me, at least, that he didn't have some pre-existing conditions, especially the anatomical shortcomings that he had when he joined the county and they became proximate to his heart attack. I get that, but that he didn't develop them while he was on the job.
And Jerry, can I answer that real quick?
Please.
So he started work in the sheriff's department in his early 20s, from what I understand. And under the injury causation paragraph, it says severe atherosclerotic and hypertensive cardiovascular disease. More than likely, that developed over the 20 years he was working as a deputy. So I don't think he walked onto the job with those conditions. I think that developed over time.
May I make a legal comment here?
Please.
Thank you. Under Government Code Section 317.20.5, which is the heart trouble presumption for safety members, pre-existing conditions cannot legally be used to rebut the presumption.
Thank you, Karen.
Hey, Todd, just one thing. When he got hired, he had a medical exam that covers that. Okay, and when a deputy sheriff gets hired, they have a medical exam that qualifies them, they have to pass, and that covers the heart, that covers the back, to make sure that they don't have these problems pre-existing before they come in. And if they do, they usually fail them for their medical. So I take it that he didn't have this when he got hired because he had that medical, and they would have found that and would have disqualified him from being hired.
Thank you, Louie. And just to build on that before I want to let Jerry have the floor back, but that's important or that's interesting information. But what I just heard from Karen is, regardless of that, even if he did have a pre-existing condition, that can't be factored in.
Unless we're not here to try and rewrite the law, but am I the only one that seems to think that that is totally illogical? That if someone had a pre-existing, I'm not saying it was in this case, but let's assume this individual had a pre-existing set of factors that could in fact lead to a cardiac event at some later date. And he took his job knowing that that existed, or not even knowing, but that it was developed prior to the job, that tank can't be taken into consideration as a rebuttable fact. That seems totally illogical to me.
I agree. I mean, if it's a cause of death, I don't know how you would not take it into account. I mean, it seems to me, if I'm listening to what the statute says, it's not relevant and can't be used, I presume, if it wasn't a or the cause of death. But if it was a cause of death, if it was medically determined to be that this condition was a proximate cause or the proximate cause of the death, it seems to me it's not only relevant, it's required that it be considered. So I don't know that blanket statutory statement would preclude use of a pre-existing condition if it were determined to be the cause. Am I correct in that?
The statute does say that pre-existing conditions cannot be used to rebut the presumption.
Thank you.
Well, okay. I mean, I hear that. That's sort of repeating what the statute says. But what I'm saying is, if the cause of death was a pre-existing condition that was not a heart condition, just to kind of cut to the chase here, it seems to me that that's highly relevant and should be taken into consideration and would be taken into consideration. I detected in the medical information provided in these confidential reports that there is a distinction between the condition of the arterial system and its degradation over time and the condition of the heart and the causative elements that bring about, in this case, a fatal heart event. So it seems to me that the condition of the arterial system is relevant because that's not a heart issue, right? That's how I read it and understood it based on the reports that were provided, in the packet.
Scott, I'm sorry. You're saying that you're not sure that the coronary artery vascular issue is a heart issue?
I'm saying that the information that was in the packet suggested that there are elements of the arterial system throughout the body that could fail, for instance, and not be considered heart trouble. I couldn't read it any other way.
Okay. So he died of a heart attack. And that was due to a buildup of worsening disease over a period of time. When he joined the sheriff's department in his 20s, it's highly unlikely that he had significant disease at that time. So this was something that progressed over time, especially with the ventricular hypertrophy due to hypertension and so forth. I just don't see this as pre-existing. I mean, there may have been a slight degree of something going on with him when he was 20 years old, but this is something that just develops over time, gets worse, and unfortunately for him, it was fatal before you could intervene.
Yeah, and I guess the frustration, I hear everything you just said, and it makes entirely good sense to me. And I think the problem for us in the situation we're in here, in having this application come before us with this type of, I would say, scant information, is that we're all speculating to one degree or another in terms of what happened 20 years ago. I think he was an 18-year employee, and what his physical condition was when he started employment. Louis made a great point. The inbound physical should at least give us a baseline or the department a baseline of understanding someone's physical condition and where they get, if they can pass the hurdle to actually be employed. So that's important. But the point is, the person dies and we're doing this all after the fact. The application for disability is filed after the fact. Medical records are reviewed and opinions are sought by people who never treated this individual nor reviewed an autopsy concerning the individual. So it's all a sort of a rear view mirror speculative construct to apply the presumption. The good news in this is we don't have to do too many of these, but when they come up, it's so difficult to wrap your head around to understand the logic of the reasoning in some of the supporting information as to why we should consider someone, quote, disabled. I still maintain that if you stop and just think about it, active death or posthumously filed disability application, hard to argue someone's disabled when they were at work up until they went on vacation. I just, intellectually, it boggles me. To find that person disabled. But I think the conundrum for me has been in trying to review this and understand it was in this context where you're coming after the fact and filing an application, in this case by the employer, who really has the obligation to, on the other side of this? It sounds like the answer is it is Cesera, and that we determined or it was determined before this case got here that the presumption couldn't be rebutted. And then we have some evidence, a lawyer letter that was obtained for that purpose, and the medical advisor's report to support that view. So it is what it is. It's before us. It just seems to me the posture of these just invites difficult discussions on causative elements, on what happened, the what ifs, and the speculation, and no one should be surprised. No one should be surprised by that. And in a case where you have an older decedent and a younger spouse, and I'm not suggesting that's the case here, but if you did, you can understand that the application of the benefit results in an actuarial effect. Is it material? I have no idea. but we didn't kid ourselves, right, about that.
With this situation, I did not read anywhere that he had suffered major health issues that required him being off work, that he was having trouble. But at the very least, we have an autopsy report that pinpoints the cause of death. And so he had been living with this, and you can have silent ischemia with the heart. So you can have heart trouble without knowing it until it's too late or close to too late. And I think that's, unfortunately, the situation with this gentleman. So, but we don't always get an autopsy report. And so that's pretty solid right there.
What I've been focusing on is the service-connected part. And we have traditionally, when we look at a service-connected disability, somebody was injured in some form. And we go through, I think Scott really talked about that, a fair amount of documentation leading up to the request for a service-connected disability. It struck me that he could have been an insurance agent and gone through exactly the same 18 years and gone on vacation and died while he was on vacation. So where I ended up on reading all this is being uncomfortable that there was a service piece to it that was any different than just everyday living that all of us have, obviously, until we don't.
The other thing that Dr. Blink's report, it's kind of self-evident when he says this, but he only speaks to a disability for an hour and 11 minutes. There's nothing that he reviewed in the way of records that suggests that disability preceded it. I mean, he says the obvious. The records indicate or make it clear that Mr. Wong was indeed totally disabled and unable to perform his duties for a period of at least 1 hour and 11 minutes. So he makes, I'm not faulting him. Perhaps he didn't have those records to look at, but there's no indication, which kind of makes some of the earlier points even more strong to me, that he suffered any disability prior to that. Now, he may not have known it, but he didn't seem to evidence it. And we don't have any record that show that he was being treated for a disability, but clearly he was disabled the last hour and 11 minutes of his life. No question about that.
Thanks, Jerry. Other comments or questions?
Just a quick point of clarification. Tim did not go with the active death option. Is this involved in this in any way, or is this just purely service-connected disability?
Not unfortunately, he did not have an active death form on file at the time of his death. And normally we would go through a process of his spouse being eligible for a non-service connected disability benefit. And rather than the option two, 60% of the unmodified would be available to her. In this case, because of him passing due to heart trouble and the heart presumption and being a safety member led to the employer filing the application for a service-connected disability.
Thank you, Tim. Any other trustee comments or questions? Hearing none, would someone like to put forward a motion?
I'll move that we deny the application on the grounds that it's not service-connected.
A motion on the floor?
Second.
Motion by Gordon, second by Phillips. Any discussion?
David? I'd just like to speak to the motion. Emotionally, I support that motion. The difficulty I have is that we have two advisors, if you will, that are suggesting this is a slam dunk. And we also have the law facing us that suggests that we can't take into account pre-existing conditions and that there's a presumption. So I wish I felt stronger about supporting the motion. I support it emotionally because I think it's a very difficult case, but I'm still debating about whether or not I can support it on the basis of any solid evidence.
And I'm with Jerry on this. I agree with you. It's one of those things where the law leans very, very heavily on the side of these presumptions that don't always make sense. And again, very similar to the active death. Yeah, they're not disabled. They're not held to the same disability standard we require everyone else who files for disability while they're alive. It's sort of this after the fact, okay, you're dead, you can't work. And it's troubling, but looking at the law, I don't know that we have any other choice given what's before us today and given that what we have before us doesn't raise any issues with regard to rebutting the presumption. And that's what I don't have to hang my hat on. And so I'm going to not be supporting the motion, even though I agree with you, Scott. It's trouble.
David?
I'd like to suggest that we table this vote, and I would request an analysis from Karen that spells out all the issues and recommendations and so forth. Is that possible?
I can answer that. So looking at all of the materials that the board received, there is nothing further that I can add. The law in terms of incapacity and the presumption is present in the material. It is correct. The application of the law to the facts by the board's disability counsel, I couldn't add to that or change anything about that. I don't have any qualifications to add to the medical advisor's report. That seems to be a report that is made by a qualified medical advisor that the board retained, reviewed all of the medical records, understands the law, both the incapacity part, the safety tier disability standard under government code section 31720, as well as the heart presumption that applies to safety members for service connection under government code section 31720.5. So I don't know what else I could add.
Thank you, Karen. Any other discussion? Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, this is Christina. I do have a comment from the widow to be read into the record as well.
Yes, before our vote, we'll do that. But prior to that, So I'm not supporting the motion. As I stated earlier, I support a service-connected disability based on the advice of our of Dr. Blank, of our disability counsel, and I heard from our general counsel that she saw nothing in our disability counsel's letter that gives her any pause. Karen, you can speak up if I'm not summarizing your assessment properly. The statements I hear, I understand some of the arguments put forth by the maker of the motion and the second, but to me, their concerns are and again, I'm summarizing someone else's, but I inferred from them there were objections to just the logic behind the laws. So to me, that's a legislative issue. And if this board wants to go forward carrying some sort of legislative adjustment to SACRS, I think that would be the more appropriate venue than applying those, you know, those statements to this case. So that's what I have to say on that. Any other discussion before we read the survivor statement into the record?
Yeah, Scott.
No. Go ahead, Louis. I've already talked enough. You can go.
I just want to. I'm against the motion. I look at his extensive medical when he got hired, his pre-employment medical. There was nothing found there, and the way the law states that it's presumed that he got it while he was at work, and it's pretty clear the way the law reads.
Louis, Scott?
I just wanted to address the point that you made, Todd, regarding maybe the purpose or the intent of the maker in terms of the motion. I'm basing it on what's before us in the record. I thought the information provided from the medical advisor and outside counsel did not adequately address the service connection issue. I get there are some, you know, the rules are what they are, and we're, you know, if we have to apply what the law is, we're not policymakers about that, and I fully understand that. I'm the motion went to the facts before us based on the content of both reports, and I just didn't feel that based on what I read that there was an adequate demonstration of service connection. Based on the medical conditions as they were discussed and described in the reports. So I just wanted to clarify, this isn't this isn't a policy issue motion. This was a motion made on that basis.
Thank you for that clarification. That's why I qualified my remarks. That's what I inferred. So I appreciate that clarification. And appreciate having you state that. Any other comments or questions? Hearing none, I'd like to invite Christina to read the survivor statement for in this case.
To the members of the CSERA board, thank you for considering my husband Walter Terrence Wong's application for a service-connected disability retirement during your meeting today. My husband, who went by Terrence, was an employee of the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office in the crime lab for over 18 years. He was a dedicated public servant who once told me that he lucked into finding a job that was just about the perfect fit for him. He was well-loved and recognized as a leader among his colleagues, and I know that he contributed significant value to the county during his time as an employee. He worked tirelessly to make our county a better and safer place to live, and he had planned to continue that work until he reached full retirement age for his position. Losing Terrence so unexpectedly and so young has been extremely difficult for our family. I know that Terrence would have thought nothing was more important than making sure that we were taken care of. While no benefit could ever make up for our loss, the retirement that you are considering today will help me make sure that our children, Elise, age 5, and Zoe, 20 months, can have the life and future that Terrence would have wanted for them. It will help relieve financial issues that have contributed additional stress at an already traumatic time. and it will honor his long and valuable legacy with the County Crime Lab. Thank you again for your consideration on this important benefit to support our family. Anna, may best.
Thank you, Christina, and thank you for that statement. Any other comments prior to taking up the motion?
May I ask, Mr. Chair, if Trustee Powell is on? Because I think he did join the meeting when this item was first taken up, but I don't see his name on the screen. Could someone confirm whether Trustee Powell is present?
I do see his name on the screen. Reggie, are you on the line?
He's muted. But he's there. There he is.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. I had some serious connection issues, so I had to move to the telephone.
Oh, no problem. No apology needed. You should have seen my line last meeting. It was awful.
All right.
But just for the record, Trustee Finley recused himself, and you will be a voting member on this item.
Correct.
Great. Okay. If there's no other statements, I'll call for a vote.
Anderson. I'm sorry. We just clarify the motion is... Certainly. Is yes. Scott's motion correct to deny the, okay, very good.
Correct. The motion on the floor is to deny a service-connected disability.
Thank you.
No, thank you. That's good clarification. So with that, I'll call Anderson. Candace.
No, I'm sorry. I'm trying David's queue, and it's not working so well. For, you know what I realize is you have to be right in front of the Zoom to do it. So anyway, no, I apologize.
No apology needed. Gordon?
Aye.
Holcomb?
No.
Kroll?
No.
MacDonald?
No.
Phillips?
Yes.
Powell?
No.
Smithy, no. And Zoo. Belinda?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Spacebar didn't work.
Yeah, I think David sold us a bill of goods.
You have to hold down the spacebar, that's why. You can't just press it, you have to hold it.
I'm teasing David. So the motion to deny a service-connected disability fails on a 7-2 vote. The chair will entertain a second motion if there's such a maker out there.
I want to make a motion to approve the disability for Mr. Wong.
There's a motion on the floor. David,
second.
Okay, motion and seconded. Any discussion on the second motion?
Todd, just clarify this service connected disability.
Understood.
Clarify the motion.
Understood. David, is that your assumption when seconding? I see David nodding in agreement. So any discussion? Hearing none, call for a vote. Anderson.
Yes.
Gordon.
No.
Holcomb.
Aye.
Kroll.
Aye.
MacDonald.
Aye.
Phillips.
No.
Powell.
Aye.
Smithy. Aye. And Zoo.
Yes.
Motion passes 7-2.